Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about some of the recent troubled history of the Congo. The Congo was a Belgian colony. The Belgians moved in the 1870s, and it was a Belgian colony until 1960. The first few years of independence were tumultuous, to say the least. There was a coup in 1965, and at that time, Joseph Mobutu came to power. He renamed the country Zaire and himself Mobutu Sese Seko. His reign there lasted more than 30 years. It ended in 1997 when he was brought down by a rebel coalition, aided by one of the neighbors, Rwanda, and led by Laurent Kabila. That, in turn, brought another several years of war, drawing in many of the country's neighbors, a war that was very destructive. It's been recently estimated that either directly or indirectly, this fighting has led to the death of 2.5 million people. That makes it one of the deadliest conflicts in Africa in recent history. This morning, in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with a British journalist who has been a foreign correspondent for all of her working life, who spent a lot of time writing about Africa. Her name is Michaela Wrong. She was born in London. She has worked for Reuters, for the Sunday Times, for the Financial Times, and now she works for the Financial Times in London. She's the author of a book that's just come out, and she's spending some time in the United States talking about it. The title of her book is In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz. The subtitle is Living on the Brink of Disaster in the Congo. It was just published in June. It's published by HarperCollins. It's her first book. And she's spending some time with us to talk about this story here this morning. Questions and comments certainly are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. And if you'd like to call in, the call will be on us, and that's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, that's the number for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Folks are welcome to call at any point. All we ask is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Ms. Wrong, hello.
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
That's a pleasure.
It certainly seems that Congo is a country that, for at least a couple of hundred years now, has been ill-used by so many outsiders, some perhaps with economic goals, some with political goals. It was the Belgians, it was the United States, more recently it's been its neighbors, but also it's been ill-used by its own, who really profited during Mobutu's reign. It's a rather sad story, spread now over a couple of centuries.
Yes, it is. It is a very sad story. I mean, there is this pattern of exploitation, and what I found interesting when I was researching the book was the way people used to copy each other. So that you had Belgium's King Leopold, who sort of set the standard, and he was taking out rubber, and people's hands were being cut off if they didn't produce enough rubber in the local villages. And when Mobutu became the president, he very consciously sort of mimicked, modeled himself on King Leopold. I mean, he even tried to buy his old house on the Riviera. He had a yacht like Leopold. He had a big chateau in Brussels. He was very much trying to be the king. And of course, you know, Mobutu's model has then been copied by, you know, Laurent Kabila, the president who was assassinated earlier this year. And the principle, which was basically, let's make the most of this country's mineral assets. Let's cream them off. Let's use them for our own purposes and not reinvest, not use them to develop the country, has been constant for years and years and years.
Mm. The Belgians started moving in the 1870s, and in 1885, the king, Leopold II, announced the establishment of Congo Free State and proclaimed himself the head. And I think you note in the book that he was the only European monarch to personally own a colony.
Yes, that's right.
And certainly he and other Belgians profited. But one of the questions I have is, was the Was the Belgian record in the Congo so much worse than the record of other colonial powers elsewhere in Africa?
Well, you know, there are so many disastrous colonial regimes in Africa, but I think it was particularly brutal because there was no attempt to develop. There was this sort of under King Leopold, there was just he wanted rubber because this was a stage in history when we were starting to manufacture tires for wheels for cars, and he wanted the rubber, he wanted the ivory, and what he essentially did is he recruited a mercenary force, and they just used to go into villages and they'd say, this is your quota, and if you don't meet your quota, you're going to pay a very high price, and if they didn't meet their quota, then they would there would be these raids, and we had these horrific images which were circulated around Europe after a couple of years of baskets full of severed hands which had been taken from people who had been punished by his forces. And I think if you look, I mean, yes, there have been disastrous colonial regimes across Africa, but it's hard to meet that level of brutality.
Certainly the criticism has been made, well made, of the colonial powers who were involved in Africa, that the criticism has been made that when they decided to leave, they did almost nothing to prepare the people of their former colonies for independence. They basically just packed up and left. And certainly the Belgians did that, as other countries did. But again, I wondered, was their record here also perhaps worse? Did they do an even worse job than some other countries when they left?
Well, there was this principle which was actually stated at one stage of, you know, don't train any elites because then you don't have any potential enemies within the state. So keep people, sort of give them a secondary education at school maybe, but no higher than that. So when the independence was finally granted, there were only about 17 graduates in the country. And the Belgians had this incredibly patronizing approach. They had this section of the local community who were described as évolué. They were evolved, which is an extraordinary way to refer to local people. This meant that these were the Congolese who were kind of regarded as having, you know, they were educated enough, they were sophisticated enough, they were urban enough to be regarded as almost European. So I think that tells you a lot about the attitude that led up to independence. And it did mean that the really, you know, the independence came as the most almighty shock to that country. I mean, it was a welcome shock, but by God, they weren't ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly think that that's the pattern that you see elsewhere, that European powers came in and they knew that they had to essentially have middle managers that they could run the country through. And those were the people that they gave what rewards were available to. Those people became educated. And so then those were the people that would have been best positioned to assume control and then continue to profit once the Europeans had left.
Well, I mean, in Congo, the middle managers were white Belgians who were going out there. And, you know, this was after Leopold had handed over control of the colony to the Belgian government. And they went out there to work. So they didn't really want local Congolese to be, you know, qualified for those jobs because they were providing employment for Belgians.
When the country became independent in 1960, there was several years of unrest that was, and here again we see the involvement of another outside power, this one being the United States, because here now we're in the period of the Cold War. U.S. involvement was shaped by our concerns during the Cold War, and particularly our concerns that one of the leaders that emerged Patrice Lumumba, who became prime minister, was leaning towards the Soviet Union, and that was something that we decided that we didn't want. This, how much was the United States involved in what happened in Congo, say, between the time of independence and then the Mobutu coup in 1965?
Well, what had happened was Lumumba, as you say, the first prime minister, had gone over to Belgium when they were discussing independence with the Belgian officials. And he went there with a delegation. and the CIA, the U.S. Embassy, started taking an interest in the whole in these developments because it saw that sort of Central Africa was going to be a potential linchpin for the whole of the continent, and they invited the delegation to a cocktail party and started talking to Lumumba, and they also started talking to his private secretary and sort of noticed this man and thought, this man is someone we can do business with. And this was very early on, and then later they developed all these fears that Lumumba was someone that you couldn't do business with because he was flirting with the Soviets and he was very, you know, he was a very fiery and unpredictable person. So there was, right from the start, they talent-spotted Mobutu because that man was Mobutu. And then got very close to him. Larry Devlin was the CIA station chief who was stationed in Kinshasa. And he and Mobutu were very close. I think, you know, there was heavy U.S. Pressure, nudging and winking behind the scenes because Mobutu staged a first coup in 1960. And then he did hand over to a civilian administration. And then there was a second coup in 1965 when he didn't hand over. So I think, you know, we may never know exactly how involved the CIA and the U.S. State Department was, but they certainly had decided that Mobutu was their man very early on.
Let me just real quick here reintroduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're speaking with Michaela Wrong. She's been a foreign correspondent for a long time. She was born in London and has worked for a number of different British news organizations, including Reuters and the Sunday Times, and currently works for the Financial Times in London. She's written a book about some of her experiences in Africa, which is titled In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, and the subtitle Living on the Brink of Disaster in the Congo. It just came out in June, and the book is published by HarperCollins and is in bookstores if you want to look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. You spent some time talking with this man who had been the CIA station chief, Mr. Devlin, and he told you that there was indeed a CIA plan to kill Patrice Lumumba that apparently didn't come off, although he did die. He was murdered. Is there really any way to say, was the CIA directly involved in that, or was this just a matter of that's what the United States and the CIA wanted to see happen, and it happened, so they didn't particularly care how it happened?
Yes, I think it was very, very fortuitous the way things worked out. I mean, there was this plot. Larry Devlin was given orders from Washington to arrange for Lumumba to be poisoned, and it was all very baroque and surreal because he was supposed to put poison in his toothpaste. And he reckons, I mean, when I was speaking to him, he reckons that he could have done it fairly easily, but he didn't want to do it. And he sort of doesn't go into it in any more detail than that. But what we do see is that sort of later on, quite soon, Lumumba had been thrown into jail. He'd escaped. He was thrown into jail again. Mobutu and the other people who were running the show in Kinshasa dispatched him down to the south. And in the south, there had been a secession movement, and there was a government there that loathed Lumumba because Lumumba was someone who wanted to keep the country together. And they took him off the plane. He was beaten up on the plane. He was taken off the plane, and he was shot in the woods in front of a lot of Belgian collaborators because the Belgians had very close ties with that southern government. I know that Belgium's going through this whole soul-searching exercise at the moment about its role in the killing of Patrice Lumumba. I think America's role was probably less pronounced, but, you know, it suited them fine, and there would have been a lot of nudging and winking going on behind the scenes.
When the second coup happened, the 65 coup, the one in which Mobutu did not hand power over, he kept it. Were there people at that time who perhaps thought maybe that wouldn't be so bad, maybe that Mobutu might not be bad for the Congo?
Yeah, well, I mean, up till then, there had been this sort of five-year period in which the sort of fact that Congo was not ready for independence had really shown itself, because what had happened is there was this endless wrangling going on between Lumumba and the president. They were constantly announcing that the other person had been sacked, that the army was loyal to them. There was all sorts of shenanigans going on, and the whole country sort of seemed to be in danger of just falling apart, and the army was very mutinous. So when you had this young man who seemed to be able to bring the army under control, he seemed to be idealistic, he seemed to want the best, it was actually extraordinarily popular when Mobutu took over. And if you talk to Congolese people, they won't deny that. They will say there was a sigh of relief. You know, people were rejoicing the day that Mobutu took over. So, you know, he may have ended up as a sort of sleazy, corrupt dictator who was hated by the public, but that's not the way he started out.
Mm-hmm. You and I think a lot of other journalists and writers, I think, have all used the same word to talk about what happened to Zaire during the time that Mobutu ran the country, and that word is kleptocracy, this idea that somehow stealing became institutionalized in this country, from top to bottom. And I suppose it might be for the people at the top, it was just a matter of grabbing as much as they could, and for the people who are near the bottom, it was just a matter of surviving.
Yeah.
But how is it that indeed became that way over that 30 some years?
Well, I think what happened is you had this very this flourishing mineral sector in Congo. That was where they got most of their money from, and there was this copper mining industry, and later on the diamond industry emerged as very big. There was gold, there was uranium, and I think what a lot of people said about Mobutu was he was a political genius, but economically he didn't understand how to run an economy. And he had the approach of a sort of child in a sweet shop, i.e. you just take, you take and you take and you take, and you never reinvest, you never maintain, you don't worry about paying the workers. And, of course, eventually if you do that, the whole system just collapses. And what happened is that, you know, sometimes the annual receipts from Gécamines, which was a state copper mining company, would just disappear. And then people would discover that they had turned up in Mobutu's private bank accounts in Switzerland. And he sort of never realized that that wasn't something you could keep doing, that if you eventually kept doing that, then everyone below you is going to mimic you. They're going to copy your behavior. So the mines end up closing down, and then everybody's unemployed. And what you do is you get a sort of whole system in which everybody is behaving like that because they don't see why they should be more moral or high-minded when they see that the president is on the take.
Mm. And the end result was literally that while some people indeed got wealthy, the country became bankrupt.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Congo now owes, I think it's $14 billion in foreign debt abroad. I mean, it is up to its eyes in debt. And more crucially, I mean, its copper industry has ground to a virtual halt. Diamonds, yes, they're vibrant, but they just get smuggled out. So nobody benefits from the diamonds much if they're just ordinary citizens. And it's the kind of place that's avoided by businessmen across the continent, which is an absolute tragedy.
How much of the blame do you think should go to any outside powers who continue to lend money, knowing what Mobutu's record had been?
Well, I think it's extraordinary if you look at the record, because what happened is that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank in Washington kept lending to Mobutu long after it was obvious what he was up to, long after it was clear that the average ordinary Zairean was not doing, was not benefiting from this funding. I mean, the aid kept flowing right up until the 1990s when they finally cut it off. And the reason for that, of course, was the Cold War imperative. You know, this guy may be awful, but he's our dictator, was the line coming out of places like Washington. Paris had the same approach. Britain probably did, Belgium did, I just find it amazing looking back that it went on as long as it did, and I'm also amazed that, you know, World Bank and IMF officials don't feel more embarrassed about their institution's record there.
Mm. So then that brings us, perhaps we can go to 97. So we have a country here that is literally bankrupt. There is a great deal of poverty. The head of state, his health is declining, so he's perhaps not in a position to exercise the kind of control that he did. And so we have a rebel insurgency. aided in large part by a neighbor, Rwanda, led by Laurent Kabila, that comes in and Mobutu is overthrown. Kabila becomes president. You were there at the time. What was this like?
Well, yes, I was in Kinshasa, and I'd also spent a lot of time with that rebel movement as they kind of marched across the country, because it took them about 9 months. It was a very tense time, because everybody was saying Kinshasa's going to go up in flames. You know, the rebels are going to get to Kinshasa, and Mobutu's presidential guards, who were the only kind of part of the army who were reckoned to be decently armed and disciplined enough to fight, that'll be where they stage their last stand. So it was a very, very tense period. In fact, people were so worried about what was going to happen that there had been a kind of 3,000 sort of marines and special commandos had been assembled across the river in Brazzaville, the idea being that they were going to take the whites out of Kinshasa if things got really nasty. In the end, you know, it sort of all fizzled away to nothing, because what happened is that Mobutu's presidential guards just sort of gave up without a fight. They all changed into tracksuits. I remember a lot of them did it in the hotel where I was staying, because it turned out that I happened to be staying in the hotel, which was a big gathering point for them. And I saw them sort of taking off their uniforms, getting into tracksuits, taking their families, and they just crossed the river and they got out. Because that was what Mobutu was so interesting about Mobutu, that in the end, nobody would fight for him. He hadn't, you know, he had lost so much credibility that no one was going to risk their life for him.
You were talking a little earlier about the fact that in the first years after independence, there had been so much unrest that perhaps some people, when Mobutu came along and staged that second coup, perhaps there were people who said, well, maybe now there will be some order and things will settle down. I expect people probably felt the same way about Laurent Kabila.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he was welcomed I remember his forces watching these young boys walking into the city, because most of them were just young boys. They certainly looked it. And people were coming out and they were cheering. They had white bandanas around their heads, which was their way of signaling that they were on their side. The rebels had told people, put white bandanas around your heads. So there was a sort of sense of, right, oh, a new chance. You know, we can start again with this man. And what was so tragic, of course, was that, you know, within a year, the country was back at war again, and essentially Kabila was, like Mobutu, only worse.
Well, how much of this did indeed have to do with the fact that Congo's renamed again, becomes the Democratic Republic of Congo, that Congo's neighbors, all for political reasons, also become involved in Congo's politics?
Yes, I mean, if you look at the last few years of history, what I think is clear is that Zaire, what was Zaire, has become a kind of area that it's a weak, kind of vast sort of chasm in the heart of Central Africa. And because of its tendency, Mobutu had this tendency to host sort of rebel movements, and they would sort of, in Rwanda's case, the rebel movements would settle in Zaire and then use that as a jumping-off point and stage all sorts of raids into Rwanda and sort of blow up schools and shoot up buses. The neighbors of Congo just decided they didn't want to put up with that anymore. They've now, it sort of seems to have become a free-for-all. You know, it's a country that's been nibbled away and invaded and appropriated, bits of it appropriated by its neighbors. But that also is a symptom of how weak Mobutu had become, because he always gave the impression that he was a strong ruler, that this was a sort of strong nation state, but there was nothing he could do to stop people just taking the bits they wanted.
We're at our midpoint here. We're talking with British journalist Michaela Wrong. Her book is In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. It's published by HarperCollins. The book came out in June. And she's spending some time in the United States talking about it. She currently works for the Financial Times in London. She's also worked for Reuters, for the Sunday Times, I think also for BBC, and has reported from Africa and also other places around the world. We have a caller. We'll get right to. Others are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Caller here is Champaign County and line 1. Hello.
Hi. While you were doing the historical survey, I thought of that it might be good to say a few words about the Katanga province and the way that the UN was manipulated. I think it was maybe one of the first times the U.S. Really manipulated the UN, sort of a early Gulf War phenomenon, in my opinion, anyway. But I don't know if you have anything on that. It's also, it seems to me, the copper was really the sort of the plum there, and that Kennecott Copper and whatever other the names of the companies at the time, U.S. firms, were advocates for certain positions. I don't know whether you have anything on that. But this last bit about the hosting guerrillas, I mean, of course, that was one of the major functions of Mobutu for the U.S. was the bleeding of Angola and the hosting of Savimbi and the supply lines to Savimbi and various times in the battle for between Angola and South Africa. And so I just, you know, it's clear that Mobutu got a pass for hosting his guerrillas and the chaos there, mainly the same way that, you know, he was, because he was functioning in the way the U.S. Wanted it to do, and it's sort of distressing that this is just down the memory hole, that the Clark Amendment and that sort of thing, which is sort of parallel to the Bolin Amendment in Central America. The U.S. role is so central, and we basically sort of just say, step back and say, well, what a mess it is, and we'll help with some free trade. And I'll have to hang up and listen, and thanks a lot for your work.
All right. Well.
I think that caller certainly knows his history. I mean, he's obviously been following it closely. The UN operation in Katanga was fascinating. There is a very good book. I think it was Conor Cruz O'Brien, who was an Irish journalist who at that stage was a big player in the UN UN operation. I mean, it was an operation that got completely out of hand. And it's also been described in Banana Sunday, which is a sort of a book of anecdotes about journalists in that era. So, yes, I think there were a lot of... ironically, I think you'll find that the UN tends to look back on that as a fairly successful operation, which makes me wonder what they're comparing it to. But it was a very dramatic time, and I think it was a time when the UN began to learn a lot of things about how operations can get out of control.
All right, let's go to another call. This is Princeville. It's line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple of brief comments and then a specific question. The first was I just wanted to comment on the statement that that you all had made about when the colonial powers did not prepare the African nations for independence and that they pretty much simply left, that while that's true, it certainly obscures the extent to which the European corporate and now multinational interests have been integrally involved in the former colonial nations after independence, especially regarding mineral and other natural resources. While it's not dealing specifically with Zaire, one wonderful novel, Destination Biafra, I imagine you're familiar with, by Buchi Emecheta, looks at that transition period in Nigeria and the different European, the extent of European involvement in her nation, as well as the different factions within Nigeria. Second briefer comment. And so when Lumumba was assassinated in the mid to late 60s, one thing that was very interesting in the States is that was the only international assassination that the United States openly took credit for. There even was a New York Times article after that in 1967 that talked about our involvement in that coup. And it's interesting. You know, it's certainly odd that, or interesting that that's the only international assassination where there was open acknowledgement at the time. I don't know if because it was Africa, we were more willing to acknowledge that. But then I had a question about the Kabila. It's very interesting, and I'm I'd like to know what discussion there has been about this, what seems to have been a staged coup or some sort of fake liberation movement with Kabila, when Mobutu had one foot in the grave with, if I remember correctly, I think it was prostate cancer.
Yes.
It's very unusual to imagine any effort to put together such an orchestrated coup with individuals going through the country, mainly outsiders, largely non-Zairians, having some sort of fake little retraining places with some pseudo-communist tracks. And
yes.
it seemed from the get-go totally fake. And my sense, as someone way on the outside, just way up, you know, over here in rural United States, that it seemed that with Mobutu having one foot in the grave, no clear successor, that the corporate mineral interests wanted to make sure that there would be a continual flow of natural resources and needed to come up with some person to take Mobutu's place, even though for 30 years there have been opposition leaders, expatriates and people in the country who would have worked to have put together some kind of leadership in the country. And now with Kabila gone and his son in power, who doesn't even speak the language of the people.
I think he does speak it. He just doesn't speak it very well.
Right.
What I gather. But I take your point, but I do tend to think one can overdo the corporate shenanigans behind. I mean, that's been an important part of African history, there's absolutely no doubt. But what I think is interesting is if you look at Congo today, the mineral assets, because I assume you're talking about Western corporations playing a behind-the-scenes role. I mean, in Congo today, the mineral assets have been sort of abused and exploited by the six regional countries that are involved in this conflict. So I think, you know, that I never really swallow this line nowadays. When people are talking about Congo, it may apply to some other countries in Africa, but in Congo, when people say, "Oh, but it's all the Western companies that want us, to get access to the mineral assets of Congo," because it's not. I think it's if you look, it's the Zimbabwean army who's doing very well out of diamonds, or is trying to. The Namibian army has got a diamond mining concession in Congo. The Rwandans and Ugandans are exploiting the gold and the diamonds in the east. It's not big Western companies anymore.
So it's very complicated, including primarily the Belgians, but certainly African organized exploitation of the resources.
Well, I think you know that as I was saying earlier, there are patterns that get mimicked. And the other thing is, if you look at there are only certain minerals that you can exploit in that way, because diamonds are a very easy thing to find. All you have to do is stand in a river and sift through the water, and you'll end up with diamonds. But if you're going to mine copper, you have to have conveyor belts, you have to have heavy equipment, you have to have trucks, you have to have chemicals. Of course, if you're if you were to go, I've been around those mines, and if you were to go today, I mean, these places are just, they're sort of factories that produce nothing but rust. I mean, they are barely functioning. So, again, when people talk about exploiting the mineral resources, Congo is rich in resources, but a lot of them are now out of reach of any company at all, because you'd have to invest so much in the infrastructure. So it's true of diamonds, but it's a lot less true of copper. I don't think anyone's going to be making a lot of money out of copper. Cobalt, maybe a little bit. But these are not easy minerals to process and get out of a country. You know, you have to have roads to send these minerals down. If you saw the state of Congo's roads, you'll know that it's very difficult to get a truck loaden with metal tailings out of that country.
And that's especially tragic in light of the fact that when Zaire gained independence, it had one of the most developed infrastructure
Absolutely,
in Africa that just eroded over the years of Mobutu. I'll get off the phone, but if you could just comment a bit about the odd way that Kabila came into power and those sort of odd staged...
Yes, I think it was odd. I mean, I was there at the time and spent a lot of... There was definitely an element that Kabila was a stooge. The real fighting that was to get rid of Mobutu was done by Rwandan soldiers, and it was done by people from Angola, soldiers from Angola. They were the real fighters, and Kabila was very much the sort of puppet who had been put in. But what happened over time is that movement changed, and as people saw this rebel force just marching across this country, and they saw that Mobutu's troops were just fleeing. I mean, they were changing out of their clothes, and they were running, and they were looting, and they weren't fighting. They were just getting the next sort of truck out of town. I think Kabila began to, you know, he went from being an outside foreign imposed stooge to becoming a genuinely popular leader. So there was this sort of interesting phenomenon. But by the time he got to Kinshasa, there was still a certain amount of suspicion towards him. But, you know, the whole thing had just sort of folded inwards. And it had gone from being an invasion, which is the way people used to refer to it, to being something approaching a national movement.
Well, why is it, though, that he never was really able to consolidate his control?
Well, his big mistake was that the reason he had been backed by the Rwandans was because they wanted to get rid of the genocidal killers, the Hutu extremists who had carried out Rwanda's genocide in 1994. They were in Zaire. They were using it as a base to attack Rwanda. And Kabila got into power because the Rwandans wanted to sweep through that area of eastern Zaire and get rid of those guys and sort of break up those camps where they were rearming. They managed to do that, and then Kabila, in an extraordinary about-face, recruited those Hutu extremists and started training them so that they would join his army. And this was regarded by the Rwandans as the ultimate betrayal. This was kind of like, these people, you know, committed the genocide, and you are now incorporating them in your army. So when that happened, Rwanda got ready, and they said, well, you know, we got rid of Mobutu. We can get rid of Kabila, and that's what we're going to do. And once there was a second war going on, then any kind of plans of reconstruction or sort of development or funding, that was just not going to happen. And to be quite honest, I mean, Kabila had a wonderful talent for alienating all the people that Mobutu had been so clever about getting on board. You know, he would insult foreign diplomats. He would refuse to deal with people like the IMF. He would turn UN negotiators. He would arrange for them to be sort of stoned when they went on trips trying to investigate human rights abuses. I mean, he had a wonderful talent for making sure that nobody, by the end of his first year in power, was even talking to him.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with British journalist Michaela Wrong. If you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for her recent book, which is titled In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz. It's published by HarperCollins. And
it comes out this month. I mean, it should already be in the bookstores by now, hopefully.
Very, very good. So it's out there if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller back here in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to have Ms. Wrong contribute to the ongoing debate on the situation in the Congo.
Thank you.
Yes, and we look forward to your book because, again, it will add to the number of studies that have been that are coming out on this topic. I want to, first of all, let me introduce myself. My name is Bokamba. I'm on the faculty here. And I come from the Congo. This is an area that I've been following rather closely in the past 30 years or so. First of all, with regard, I'll comment briefly on a couple of things and make some, raise more questions. With regard to the World Bank and International Monetary Fund's rescheduling and loaning of money to Mobutu, it has become evident, there have been a number of studies on this that have shown that the World Bank was doing that in the interest of the West because of the resources that Mobutu produced, Radio Congo at that time, Zaire, was able to produce. And that, secondly, Mobutu, as you quite correctly pointed out, was the CIA man in the Congo. He was the equivalent of the Noriega, et cetera, et cetera, and did the, you know, job there. And therefore, they found that supporting him was better than, you know, stopping him from squandering the funds and oppressing, you know, his people, especially after his first 5 years. And again, here you were correct. Initially, he was popular, so popular that the general student union in the Congo, UGEC, known by his French name, Union Générale des Étudiants Congolais, supported them only after being the second person to be supported in that regard after Lumumba. Mm-hmm. They never supported any political politician, but they supported him.
Mm.
He was viewed as a nationalist, but then he started playing footsie with the Belgians and the West, etc. Secondly, with regard to the invasion of Zaire by the rebels that were led by Kabila, the truth of the matter is that Kabila was an inconsequential rebel that Mobutu ignored for many years. Kabila was plucked out of obscurity by Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi, Rwanda being the engineer of that plot. True, they wanted to get rid of the Interahamwe, etc., that were in the Congo, which the UN had neglected. We know the whole story. Care of. However, once they were in, they wanted to go further, but they thought that the international community would not be in support of that. So guess what? They found a rebel and propped him, so that's the person that went. And the story of this, if you follow closely, you will find that during Kabila's first year in office, he was surrounded by Rwandan officers.
Mm.
His entire security was in their hands. There were agreements for these officers to go in and out of the Congo. In fact, the chief of the army was none other than Kabarehe, who was an officer in the Rwandan army. So the first year he was taken hostage, his mistake, serious mistake, was in not working quickly enough with the opposition to build a basis, a political basis, upon which he would have moved the movement further. And is sending them home after a year was due to the pressure put on him by the Congolese people. I happen to have been in the Congo in December, and these are some of the things that I learned in place, besides having colleagues who worked in his government and so on. So that as a stubborn and an insecure person, he managed, you're quite right here again, to alienate everybody possible, but that's because he realized he was in power and wanted power.
Yes, I mean, I remember when Kabila took over,
yes,
the days when we were in Kinshasa, and he was saying, I'm just a spokesman for this movement. I'm going to retire, and I might go to my farm. I'm just a spokesman. I don't want to be president. And then the next thing we know, we have him announcing that he's the new president.
That's right. That's right.
And then, you know, then he doesn't want to leave. And no. Just a fairly classic pattern.
Right, so that's what it. But one of the points that I want to make in this regard is that the second invasion, which is claimed to be by Congolese, you know, rebels, etc., etc., one of whom is a colleague of mine, Wamba Diawamba, who studied in this country and so on. I know Wamba Diawamba well. Was a repetition of the formula used in bringing Kabila to power. The Wamba Diawamba, Ilunga, and so on came into the picture only 2 weeks after the officers who were kicked out of Kinshasa, okay, liberated those who were in training in Kitona, in the Bakongo area. So the movement was not initiated by the rebels, but instead Rwanda wanted to exploit this patriot and stay expand in the Congo.
Right. No, I agree entirely with you. I think that's a very correct interpretation of events. The thing is that I think what you've got in Congo today is that nobody really supports anybody there. I mean, you know, you have a Kinshasa government that claims to talk for the people, you know, but who voted for Joseph Kabila, this new guy that is being feted in Washington? Well, nobody voted for him. Nobody ever voted for Laurent Kabila. The rebel movements that are active in the East, again, I mean, what support do they have? How can we tell? Because, you know, there's never any way of finding out whether they have any popular support. And that's one of the things that's really sad.
They don't. One of your colleagues, Colette Bretman, who writes from Belgium, Le Soir, has detailed some of the level of support that these so-called rebels are not getting from the areas where they are located. They're very, very unpopular. And one reason for unpopularity is that they're not seen as real liberators, but on the contrary, as puppets of Rwanda, with the support of Uganda and Burundi. So it's erroneous for the, you know, mass media to continue saying the rebels that are supported by, they're not supported, they were invented and created by these Rwandans, and for their own economic reasons. And in part, you're quite right in saying Angola, Zimbabwe, and Namibia have profited from the minerals as well. But that is the price that Kabila had to pay to be able to secure their support, whereas the Rwandans and the Ugandans, who fought in Kisangani and killed thousands of people, were there for their own benefit, so much so that they are exporting gold, exporting, you know, diamonds.
Yes, I'm familiar with that phenomenon.
Mine of.
Yeah.
You see, now, how can resource-poor countries such as Rwanda and Uganda be able to sustain 2 years of a war in the Congo, where part of the answer is IMF and World Bank? Look at the money they've loaned.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think we have to ask a question when we're funding through the IMF and the World Bank, and we're funding countries like Uganda, because everyone thinks that Museveni is a wonderful president. But you have to think, well, Uganda has been involved in all sorts of wars across Africa. So why are we sort of so convinced that this is a country that we want to help through the IMF and World Bank?
I've got to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller, but I need to jump in because we're almost out of time. We perhaps maybe have about a minute left. I guess I'd just like to give you, Ms. Rong, a chance to make a final comment, particularly just from your perspective, what you have seen and what you think is likely here to happen in Congo over the near term.
Well, I think it's at a sort of turning point at the moment because there's a new president in power and everyone's hoping that he can change things. Essentially, what I'd like to see is some action on the ground because I've seen so many Congolese who are just living off their wits and they sort of find the most inventive and amazing ways to survive. And that's what my book really talks about. And there's a large part of it's just dedicated to these wacky individuals in Kinshasa who find these extraordinary survival techniques. I found that absolutely fascinating. And I would just like to see people like that getting a chance because finally there is some money going into the infrastructure and into the health and education and hospitals.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Our guest, Michaela Rong, she's foreign correspondent. She currently works for, has been a longtime foreign correspondent. She currently works for the Financial Times in London. And again, if you would like to read her book, it's titled In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. And it's published by HarperCollins.